Have you got manuscript paper in here, or should I have Hendrick go and get some?" Relief that V.A. hadn't come to catch me tupping his wife made his imposition seem less preposterous than it actually was. "So fine," I said, "yes, I have paper, I have pens, let's start." Ez's sight was too poor to see anything suspicious in the foothills of my bed, but Hendrick still posed a possible danger. One should avoid relying on servants' discretion. After Hendrick had helped his master to a chair and wrapped a rug round his shoulders, I told him I'd ring for him when we were done. Ayres didn't contradict me. He was already humming. A conspiratorial flicker in H's eyes? Room too dim, to be sure. The servant gave a near imperceptible bow and glided away as if on well-oiled coasters, softly shutting the door behind him. Splashed a little water on my face at the washbowl and sat opposite Ayres, worrying Jay might forget the creaking floorboards and try to tiptoe out. "Ready?" Ayres hummed his sonata, bar by bar, then named his notes. The oddity of the miniature soon absorbed me, despite the circumstances. It's a seesawing, cyclical, crystalline thing. He finished after the 96th bar and told me to mark the MS Triste. Then he asked me, "So, what do you think?" "Not sure," I told him. "It's not at all like you. Not much like anyone. But it hypnotizes." Ayres was now slumped, a la a pre-Raphaelite oil painting entitled "Behold, the Sated Muse Discards Her Puppet." A birdsong phoned in the hour before dawn garden. Thought about Jay's curves in the bed, just a few yards away. Even felt a dangerous throb of impatience for her. V.A. was unsure of himself, for once. "I dreamt of a nightmarish cafe. Brilliantly lit, but underground, with no way out. I'd been dead a long, long time. The waitresses all had the same face. The food was soap. The only drink was cups of lava. The music in the cafe was..." He wagged an exhausted finger at the MS. "This." Rang for H. Wanted Ayres out of my room before daylight found his wife in my bed. After a minute, H knocked. Ayres got to his feet and limped over. He hates anyone seeing him assisted. "Good work, Frobisher," his voice found me from down the corridor. I shut the door and breathed that big sigh of relief, climbed back to bed where my swampy, sheeted alligator sank her little teeth into her young prey. We'd begun a luxuriant farewell kiss when, damn me, the door creaked open again. "Something else, Frobisher!" Mother of all profanities, I hadn't locked the door. Ayres drifted bedward like the wreck of the Hesperus. Jay slid back under the sheets while I made disheveling, surprised noises. Thank God Hendrick was waiting outside. Accident or tact? V.A. found the end of my bed and sat there, just inches from the bump that was Jay. If Jay sneezed or coughed now, even blind old Ayres would catch on. "A tricky subject, so I'll just spit it out. Jocasta. She isn't a very faithful woman. Maritally, I mean. Friends hint at her indiscretions. Enemies inform me of affairs. Has she ever... toward you... you know my meaning?" Let my voice stiffen masterfully. "No, sir, I don't believe I do know your meaning." "Spare me your bashfulness, boy," Ayres leant nearer. "Has my wife ever made advances? I have a right to know." Avoided a nervous giggle by a whisker. "I find your question distasteful in the extreme." Jocasta's breath dampened my thigh. She must have been roasting alive under the covers. "I wouldn't call any friend who spread such muck around by that name. In Mrs. Crommelink's case, frankly, I find the notion as unthinkable as it is unpalatable. If, through some, I don't know, nervous collapse, she were to behave so inappropriately, well, to be honest, Ayres, I'd probably ask for Daunt's advice or speak to Dr. Egret." Sophistry makes a fine smokescreen. "So you're not going to give me a one-word answer?" "You shall have a two-word answer. Emphatically, no. And I very much hope the subject is now closed." Ayres let long moments fall away. "You're young, Frobisher. You're rich. You've got a brain. By all accounts, you're not wholly repugnant. I'm not sure why you stay on here." Good. He was getting mawkish. "You're my Verlaine." "Am I, young Rambo? Then where is your saison en enfer?"
"In sketches. In my skull. In my gut, Ayres. In my future."
Couldn't say if Ayres felt humour, pity, nostalgia, or scorn. He left. Locked the door and climbed into bed for the third time that night.
bedroom farce, when it actually happens, is intensely sad. Jocasta seemed angry with me. "What?" I hissed. "My husband loves you," said the wife, dressing.
Zedelchem's a stirring. Plumbing makes noises like elderly aunts. Been thinking of my grandfather, whose wayward brilliance skipped my father's generation. Once he showed me an aquatint of a certain Siamese temple, don't recall its name, but ever since a disciple of the Buddha preached on the spot centuries ago, every bandit king, tyrant, and monarch of that kingdom has enhanced it with marble towers, scented arboretums, gold-leafed domes, lavished murals on its vaulted ceilings, set emeralds into the eyes of its statuettes. When the temple finally equals its counterpart in the Pure Land, so the story goes, that day humanity shall have fulfilled its purpose, and time itself shall come to an end. To men like Ayres, it occurs to me, this temple is civilization. The masses, slaves, peasants, and foot soldiers exist in the cracks of its flagstones, ignorant even of their ignorance. Not so the great statesmen, scientists, artists, and, most of all, the composers of the age, any age, who are civilization's architects, masons, and priests. Ayres sees our role is to make civilization ever more resplendent. My employer's profoundest, or only, wish is to create a minaret that inheritors of progress 1,000 years from now will point to and say, "Look, there is Vivian Ayres." How vulgar! This hankering after immortality, how vain, how false! Composers are merely scribblers of cave paintings. One writes music because winter is eternal, and because, if one didn't, the wolves and blizzards would be at one's throat all the sooner. Sincerely, R.F.
Zedelchem, 14th, 9, 1931.
Sixsmith. Sir Edward Elgar came to tea this afternoon. Even you've heard of him, you ignoramus. Now, usually, if one asks Ayres what he thinks of English music, he'll say, "What English music? There is none, not since Purcell," and sulk all day, as if the Reformation were one's own doing. This hostility was forgotten in a trice when Sir Edward telephoned from his hotel in Bruges this morning, wondering if Ayres might be able to spare him an hour or two. Ayres made a show of curmudgeonliness, but I could tell by the way he badgered Mrs. Willems about the arrangements for tea, he was pleased as the cat who got the cream. Our celebrated guest arrived at 2:30, dressed in a dark green Inverness cape, despite the clement weather. The man's state of health isn't much better than V.A.'s. Jay and I welcomed him on the steps of Zedelchem. "So you're Viv's new pair of eyes, are you?" he said to me as we shook hands. Said I'd seen him conduct 12 times at the festival, which pleased him. Guided the composer into the scarlet room, where Ayres was waiting. They greeted each other warmly, but as if wary of bruises. Elgar's sciatic pain bothered him greatly, and even on good days V.A. looks pretty frightful at first sight, still worse at the second. Tea was served, and they talked shop, mostly ignoring Jay and me, but it was fascinating to be a fly on the wall. Sir E. glanced at us now and then to make sure he was not wearing out his host. Not at all, we smiled back. They fenced over such topics as saxophones in orchestras, whether Webern is fraudster or messiah, the patronage and politics of music. Sir E. announced he is at work on a 3rd symphony after a long hibernation. He even played us sketches of a molto maestoso and an allegretto on the upright. Ayres most eager to prove that he isn't ready for his coffin either, and had me run through some recently completed piano sketches. Rather lovely. Several dead bottles of Trappist beer later, I asked Elgar about the pomp and circumstance marches. "Oh, I needed the money, dear boy, but don't tell anyone. The king might want my baronetcy back." Ayres went into laughter spasms at this. "I always say, Ted, to get the crowd to cry Hosanna, you must first ride into town on an ass. Backwards, ideally, whilst telling the masses the tall stories they want to hear." Sir E. had heard about Todenfogel's reception in Krakow. All London has, it would seem. So V.A. sent me off to fetch a score. Back in the Scarlet Room, our guest took our death bird to the window seat and read it with the aid of a monocle, while Ayres and I pretended to busy ourselves. "A man at our time of life, Ayres," E. spoke at last, "has no right to such daring ideas. Where are you getting 'em from?" V.A. puffed up like a smug hornyback. I suppose I've won a rearguard action or two in my war against decrepitude. My boy Robert here is proving a valuable aide-de-camp.
Aide-de-camp? I'm his bloody general, and he's the fat old Turk, reigning on the memory of faded glories.
Smiled sweetly as I could, as if the roof over my head depended on it. Moreover, Sir E. might be useful one day, so it won't do to create an obstreperous impression. During tea, Elgar contrasted my position at Zedelchem favourably with his first job as a musical director at a lunatic asylum in Worcestershire.
"Excellent prep for conducting the London Philharmonic, what?"
quit V.A. We laughed, and I half forgave the ratty old selfish crank for being himself. I put another log or two in the hearth. In the smoky firelight, the two old men nodded off like a pair of ancient kings passing the eons in their tumuli. I made a musical notation of their snores. Elgar is to be played by a bass tuba, Els a bassoon. I'll do the same with Fred Delius and Trevor McCarris, and publish them all together in a work entitled The Back Street Museum of Stuffed Edwardians. 3 days later. Just back from a lento walk with V.A. down the Monk's Walk to the gatekeeper's lodge, I pushed his chair. Landscape V-atmospheric this evening. Autumn leaves gusted around in urgent spirals, as if V.A. was the sorcerer and I his apprentice. Poplar's long shadows barred the mown meadow. Ayres wanted to unveil his concepts for a final symphonic major work, to be named Eternal Recurrence in honour of his beloved Nietzsche. Some music will be drawn from an abortive opera based on The Island of Dr. Moreau, whose Viennese production was cancelled by the war. Some music V.A. believes will come to him, and its backbone will be the dream music piece that he dictated in my room that hairy night last month. I wrote to you about that. V.A. wants 4 movements, a female choir, and a large ensemble, heavy in Ayres-esque woodwind. Truly a behemoth of the deeps. Wants my services for another half year, said I'd think about it. He said he'd up my salary, both vulgar and crafty of him. Repeated I needed time. V.A. most upset I didn't give him a breathy yes on the spot, but I want the old bugger to admit to himself that he needs me more than I need him. Sincerely, R.F.
Zedelchem, 28th, 9, 1931.
Sixsmith. J. growing V. tiresome. After our love-making, she spreads over my bed like a mooing moon-calf and demands to know about other women whose strings I've quivered. Now she's teased names out of me, she says things like, "Oh, I suppose Frederica taught you that." She plays with that birthmark in the hollow of my shoulder, the one you said resembles a comet. Can't abide the woman dabbling with my skin. Jay initiates petty rows in order to undergo tedious reconciliations, and worryingly has started to let our moonlight dramas slip into our daylight lives. Ayres can't see further than Eternal Recurrence, but Eva is due back in 10 days, and that hawk-eyed creature will sniff out a decomposing secret in a jiffy. Jay thinks our arrangement lets her fasten my future more tightly to Zedelchem. She says, half-playful, half-darkly, she's not going to let me abandon either her or her husband, not in their hour of need. The devil, Sixsmith, is in the pronouns. Worst of all, she's started to use the L-word on me and wants to hear it back. What's wrong with the woman? She's nearly twice my age. What's she after? Assured her I've never loved anyone except myself, and have no intention of starting now, especially with another man's wife, and especially when that man could poison my name in European musical society by writing 6 letters. So, of course, the female plies her customary ploys, sobs in my pillow, accuses me of using her. I agree, of course, I've used her, just as she's used me, too. That's the arrangement. If she's no longer happy with it, she's not my prisoner. So off she storms to pout for a couple of days and nights until the old ewe gets hungry for a young ram, then she's back, calling me her darling boy, thanking me for giving Vivian his music back. And the stupid cycle begins all over again. I wonder if she's resorted to Hendrick in the past. Wouldn't put anything past the woman. If one of Rennick's Austrian doctors opened up her head, a whole beehive of neuroses would swarm out. Had I known she was this unstable, I'd never have let her in my bed that first night. There's a joylessness in her love-making. No, a savagery.
I've agreed to V.A.'s proposal that I stay on here until next summer, at least. No cosmic resonance entered my decision, just artistic advantage, financial practicalities, and because J. might have some sort of collapse if I went. The consequences of that would not come out in the wash.
Later, same day. Gardner made a bonfire of fallen leaves, just came in from it, the heat on one's face and hands, the sad smoke, the crackling and wheezing fire. Reminds me of the groundsman's hut at Gresham. Anyway, got a gorgeous passage from the fire, percussion for crackling, alto bassoon for the wood, and a restless flute for the flames. Finished transcribing it this very minute. Air in the chateau clammy like laundry that won't dry. Door banging draughts down the passageways. Autumn is leaving its mellowness behind for its spiky, rotted stage. Don't remember summer even saying goodbye. Sincerely, R.F.
Half Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery. 1. Rufus Sixsmith leans over the balcony and estimates his body's velocity when it hits the sidewalk and lays his dilemmas to rest. A telephone rings in the unlit room. Sixsmith dares not answer. Disco music booms from the next apartment, where a party is in full swing, and Sixsmith feels older than his 66 years. Smog obscures the stars. But north and south along the coastal strip, Buenos Yerbas' billion lights simmer. West, the Pacific eternity. East, our denuded, heroic, pernicious, enshrined, thirsty, berserking American continent. A young woman emerges from the next-door party and leans over the neighboring balcony. Her hair is shorn. Her violet dress is elegant. But she looks incurably sad and alone. Propose a suicide pact, why don't you? Sixsmith isn't serious, and he isn't going to jump either, not if an ember of humor still glows. Besides, a quiet accident is precisely what Grimaldi, Napier, and those sharp-suited hoodlums are praying for. Sixsmith shuffles inside and pours himself another generous vermouth from his absent host's minibar, dips his hands in the icebox, then wipes his face. Go out somewhere and phone Megan. She's your only friend left. He knows he won't. You can't drag her into this lethal mess. The disco thump pulses in his temples, but it's a borrowed apartment and he judges it unwise to complain. Buenos Yerbas isn't Cambridge. Anyway, you're in hiding. The breeze slams the balcony door, and in fear Sixsmith spills half his vermouth. No, you old fool, it wasn't a gunshot. He mops up the spillage with a kitchen towel, turns on the TV with the sound down low, and trawls the channels for MASH. It's on somewhere, just have to keep looking. 2. Louisa Ray hears a clunk from the neighboring balcony. Hello? Nobody. Her stomach warns her to set down her tonic water. It was the bathroom you needed, not fresh air. But she can't face weaving back through the party, and anyway, there's no time. Down the side of the building she heaves, once, twice, a vision of greasy chicken, and a third time. That, she wipes her eyes, is the third foulest thing you've ever done. She sluices her mouth out, spits residue into a flower pot behind a screen. Louisa dabs her lips with a tissue and finds a mint in her handbag. Go home and just dream up your crappy 300 words for once. People only look at the pictures anyhow. A man too old for his leather trousers, bare torso, and zebra waistcoat steps onto the balcony. Louisa! A crafted golden beard and a moonstone and jade ankh around his neck. Hiya. Come out for a little stargazing, huh? Dig. Bix brought 8 ounces of snow with him, man.
One wildcat. Hey, did I say in the interview? I'm trying on the name Ganja at the moment. Maharaj Aja says Richard is out of sync with my Ayurvedic self. Who? My guru, Louisa, my guru. He's on his last reincarnation before... Richard's fingers go poof. Nirvana words. Come to an audience. His waiting list normally takes, like, forever, but Jade Ankh disciples get personal audiences on the same afternoon. Like, why go through college and shit when Maharaj Aja can, like, teach you everything about... it. He frames the moon in his fingers. Words are so... uptight. Space. It's so, you know, like, total. Smoke some weed? Acapulco Gold. Got it off of Bix. He edges nearer. Say, Lou, let's get high after the party. Alone together, my place, dig. You could get a very exclusive interview. I may even write you a song and put it on my next LP. I'll pass. The minor league rock musician narrows his eyes. Unlucky time of the month, huh? How's next week? I thought all you media chicks are on the pill, like, forever. Does Bix sell you your pickup lines, too? He sniggers. Hey, has that cat been telling you things? Richard, just so there's no uncertainty, I'd rather jump off this balcony than sleep with you any time of the month. I really would. Whoa! His hand jerks back as if stung. Picky! Who do you think you are? Like, Joni fucking Mitchell? You're only a fucking gossip columnist in a magazine that, like, no one ever reads. 3. The elevator doors close just as Louisa Ray reaches them, but the unseen occupant jams them with his cane. Thank you, says Louisa to the old man. Glad the age of chivalry isn't totally dead. He gives a grave nod. Louisa thinks, he looks like he's been given a week to live. She presses G. The ancient elevator begins its descent. A leisurely needle counts off the stories. Its motor whines, its cables grind, but between the 10th and 9th stories, a gada 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 detonates, then dies with a fzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzz The light stutters on and off before settling on a buzzing sepia. You okay? Can you get up? The sprawled old man recovers himself a little. No bones broken, I think, but I'll stay seated, thank you. His old-school English accent reminds Louisa of the tiger in the Jungle Book. The power might restart suddenly. Christ, mutters Louisa. A power outage. Perfect end to a perfect day. She presses the emergency button. Nothing. She presses the intercom button and hollers, Hey, anyone there? Static hiss. We have a situation here. Can anyone hear us? Louisa and the old man regard each other sideways, listening. No reply. Just vague submarine noises. Louisa inspects the ceiling. Gotta be an access hatch. There isn't. She peels up the carpet. A steel floor. Only in movies, I guess. Are you still glad? Asks the old man. The age of chivalry isn't dead. Louisa manages a smile. Just. We might be here some time. Last month's brownout lasted 7 hours. Well, at least I'm not confined with a psychopath, a claustrophobe, or Richard Ganja. 4. Rufus Sixsmith sits propped in a corner 60 minutes later, dabbing his forehead with his handkerchief. I subscribed to Illustrated Planet in 1967 to read your father's dispatches from Vietnam. Lester Ray was one of only 4 or 5 journalists who grasped the war from the Asian perspective. I'm fascinated to hear how a policeman became one of the best correspondents of his generation. You asked for it. The story is polished with each retelling. Dad joined the BYPD just weeks before Pearl Harbor, which is why he spent the war here and not in the Pacific like his brother Howie, who got blown to pieces by a Japanese landmine playing beach volleyball in the Solomons. Pretty soon, it became apparent Dad was a 10th Precinct case. And that's where he wound up. There's such a precinct in every city in the country, a sort of pen where they transfer all the straight cops who won't go on the take and who won't turn a blind eye. So anyway, on VJ night, Buenas Yerbas was one citywide party, and you can imagine the police were stretched thin. Dad got a call reporting looting down on Silva Plana Wharf, a sort of no-man's land between 10th Precinct, the BY Port Authority, and Spinoza Precinct. Dad and his partner, a man named Nat Wakefield, drove down to take a look. They park between a pair of cargo containers, kill the engine, proceed on foot, and see maybe 2 dozen men loading crates from a warehouse into an armored truck. The light was dim, but the men sure weren't dock workers, and they weren't in military uniform. Wakefield tells Dad to go and radio for backup. Just as Dad gets to the radio, a call comes through saying the original order to investigate looting has been countermanded. Dad reports what he'd seen, but the order is repeated. So Dad runs back to the warehouse just in time to see his partner accept a light from one of the men and get shot 6 times in the back. Dad somehow keeps his nerve, sprints back to his squad car, and manages to radio out a code 8, a mayday, before his car shivers with bullets. He's surrounded on all sides except the dockside. So, over the edge he dives, into a cocktail of diesel, trash, sewage, and sea. He swims underneath the quay. In those days, Silva Plana Wharf was a steel structure like a giant boardwalk, not the concrete peninsula it is today, and hauls himself up a service ladder, soaked, one shoe missing, with his non-functioning revolver. All he can do is observe the men, who are just finishing up when a couple of Spinoza Precinct squad cars arrive on the scene. Before Dad can circle around the yard to warn the officers, a hopelessly uneven gunfight breaks out. The gunmen pepper the 2 squad cars with submachine guns. The truck starts up, the gunmen jump aboard, they pull out of the yard and lob a couple of hand grenades from the back. Whether they were intended to maim or just to discourage heroics, who knows? But one caught Dad and made a human pincushion of him. He woke up 2 days later in the hospital minus his left eye. The papers described the incident as an opportunistic raid by a gang of thieves who got lucky. The 10th Precinct men reckoned a syndicate who'd been siphoning off arms throughout the war decided to shift their stock now that the war was over and accounting would get tightened up. There was pressure for a wider investigation into the Silva Plana shootings. 3 dead cops meant something in 1945. But the mayor's office blocked it. Draw your own conclusions. Dad did, and they jaded his faith in law enforcement. By the time he was out of the hospital 8 months later, he'd completed a correspondence course in journalism. Good grief, says Sixsmith. The rest you may know. Covered Korea for Illustrated Planet, then became West Coast Herald's Latin America man. He was in Vietnam for the Battle of Ap Bac and stayed based in Saigon until his first collapse back in March. It's a miracle my parents' marriage lasted the years it did. You know, the longest I spent with him was April to July this year in the hospice. Louisa is quiet. I miss him, Rufus, chronically. I keep forgetting he's dead. I keep thinking he's away on assignment somewhere, and he'll be flying in any day soon. He must have been proud of you, following in his footsteps. No, Louisa Ray is no Lester Ray, I wasted years being rebellious and liberated, posing as a poet and working in a bookstore on Engels Street. My posturing convinced no one. My poetry was so vacuous it isn't even bad, so said Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and the bookstore went bust. So I'm still only a columnist. Louisa rubs her tired eyes, thinking of Richard Ganja's parting shot. No award-winning copy from War Zones. I had high hopes when I moved to Spyglass, but simpering gossip on celebrity parties is the closest I've gotten so far to Dad's vocation. Ah, but is it well-written, simpering gossip? Oh, it's excellently written, simpering gossip. Then don't bemoan your misspent life quite yet. Forgive me for flaunting my experience, but you have no conception of what a misspent life constitutes. 5. Hitchcock loves the limelight, says Louisa, her bladder now growing uncomfortable, but hates interviews. He didn't answer my questions because he didn't really hear them. His best works, he said, are roller coasters that scare the riders out of their wits but let them off at the end, giggling and eager for another ride. I put it to the great man, the key to fictitious terror is partition or containment. So long as the Bates Motel is sealed off from our world, we want to peer in, like at a scorpion enclosure. But a film that shows the world is a Bates Motel, well, that's the stuff of Buchenwald, dystopia, depression. We'll dip our toes into a predatory, amoral, godless universe, but only our toes. Hitchcock's response was, Louisa does an above-average impersonation. I'm a director in Hollywood, young lady, not an oracle at Delphi. I asked why Buenos Aires had never featured in his films. Hitchcock answered, This town marries the worst of San Francisco with the worst of Los Angeles. Buenos Aires is a city of nowhere. He spoke in bon mots like that. Not to you, but into the ear of posterity, for dinner party guests of the future to say, That's one of Hitchcock's, you know. Sixsmith wrings sweat from his handkerchief. I saw Sherrod with my niece at an art house cinema last year. Was that Hitchcock? She strong-arms me into seeing these things to prevent me from growing square. I rather enjoyed it, but my niece said Audrey Hepburn was a bubblehead. Delicious word. Charade's the one where the plot swings on the stamps. A contrived puzzle, yes, but all thrillers would wither without contrivance. Hitchcock's Buenos Aires remark puts me in mind of John F. Kennedy's observation about New York. Do you know it? Most cities are nouns, but New York is a verb. What might Buenos Aires be, I wonder? A string of adjectives and conjunctions? Or an expletive? 6. Megan, my treasured niece. Rufus Sixsmith shows Louisa a photograph of a bronzed young woman and a fitter, healthier self taken at a sunny marina. The photographer said something funny just before the shutter clicked. Their legs dangle over the stern of a small yacht named Starfish. That's my old tub, a relic from more dynamic days. Louisa makes polite noises about not being old. Truly, if I went on a serious voyage now, I'd need to hire a small crew. I still spend a lot of weekends on her, pottering about the marina and doing a little thinking, a little work. Megan likes the sea, too. She's a born physicist with a better head for mathematics than I ever had, rather to her mother's chagrin. My brother didn't marry Megan's mother for her brain, I'm sorry to say. She buys into feng shui or I Ching or whatever instant enlightenment mumbo-jumbo is top of the charts. But Megan possesses a superb mind. She spent a year of her PhD at my old college at Cambridge. A woman at Caius. Now she's finishing her radio astronomy research at the Big Dishes on Hawaii, while her mother and her stepfather crisp themselves to toast on the beach in the name of leisure. Megan and I knock around equations in the bar. Any children of your own, Rufus? I've been married to science all my life. Sixsmith changes the subject. A hypothetical question, Miss Ray. What price would you pay as a journalist, I mean, to protect a source? Louisa doesn't consider the question. If I believed in the issue, any. Prison, for example, for contempt of court? If it came to it, yes. Would you be prepared to compromise your own safety? Well, Louisa does consider this. I guess I'd have to. Have to. How so? My father braved booby-trapped marshes and the wrath of generals for the sake of his journalistic integrity. What kind of a mockery of his life would it be if his daughter bailed when things got a little tough? Tell her. Sixsmith opens his mouth to tell her everything. The whitewashing at Seaboard, the blackmailing, the corruption. But without warning, the elevator lurches, rumbles, and resumes its descent. Its occupants squint in the restored light, and Sixsmith finds his resolve has crumbled away. The needle swings round to G. The air in the lobby feels as fresh as mountain water. "I'll telephone you, Miss Ray," says Sixsmith as Louisa hands him his stick. "Soon. Will I break this promise or keep it?" "Do you know," he says, "I feel I've known you for years, not 90 minutes. 7. The flat world is curved in the boy's eye. Javier Gomez leafs through a stamp album under an angle-poised lamp. A team of huskies barks on an Alaskan stamp. A Hawaiian nene honks and waddles on a 50-cent special edition. A paddle steamer churns up an inky Congo. A key turns in the lock, and Louisa Ray stumbles in, kicking off her shoes in the kitchenette. She is exasperated to find him here. "Javier."
"Oh, hi."
"Don't oh-hi me. You promised not to jump across the balconies ever again. Suppose someone reports a burglar to the cops. Suppose you slipped and fell. Then just give me a key." Louisa strangles an invisible neck. "I can't rest easy knowing an 11-year-old can waltz into my living space whenever your mom's out all night." Louisa replaces with, "There's a slow night on TV."
"So why leave the bathroom window open?"
"Because if there's one thing worse than you jumping the gap once, it'd be you jumping the gap again when you couldn't get in."
"I'll be 11 in January."
"No key." "Friends give each other keys." "Not when one is 26 and the other is still in fifth grade."
"So why are you back so late? Meet anyone interesting?"
Louisa glares. "Trapped by the brownout in an elevator. None of your business anyhow, mister." She switches on the main light and flinches when she sees the mean red welt on Javier's face.
"What the..."
"What happened?" The boy glances at the apartment wall, then returns to his stamps. "Wolfman?" Javier shakes his head, folds a tiny paper strip, and licks both sides. "That Clark guy came back. Mom's working the graveyard shift at the hotel all this week, and he's waiting for her. He asked me stuff about Wolfman, and I told him it wasn't any of his business." Javier attaches the hinge to the stamp. "It doesn't hurt. I already dab stuff on it." Louisa's hand is already on the telephone. "Don't phone Mom. She'll rush back and there'll be a massive fight, and the hotel will fire her like last time and the time before." Louisa considers this, replaces the receiver, and starts for the door. "Don't go around there. He's sick in the head. He'll get angry and wreck our stuff, and then we'll probably get evicted or something. Please.
Louisa looks away. She takes a deep breath. Coco?
Yes, please.
The boy is determined not to cry, but his jaw aches with the effort. He wipes his eyes on his wrists.
Louisa?
Yes, Javi. You're sleeping on my sofa tonight. It's okay. 8. Dom Grelsch's office is a study in ordered chaos. The view across Third Avenue shows a wall of offices much like his own. An Incredible Hulk punching bag hangs from a metal gallows in the corner. The editor-in-chief of Spyglass magazine declares the Monday AM features meeting open by stabbing a stubby digit at Roland Jakes, a grizzled prune-like man in an Aloha shirt, flared Wranglers, and dyeing sandals. Jakes.
I want to follow up my Terror in Sewerland series to tie in with Jaws Fever. Dirk Mellon, he can be a freelance hack, is found under 50th East Street on a routine maintenance inspection. Or rather, his remains are. Dental records and tattered press pass ID him. Flesh torn from corpse in manner consistent with Sarah Salmis scapularis. I thank you, queen bitch of all piranhas, imported by fish freaks, then flushed down toilets when the meat bill gets too big. I'll phone Captain Vermin at City Hall and have him deny a spate of attacks on sewage workers. Taking notes, Louisa? Believe nothing till it's officially denied. So come on, Grouch. Time you gave me that raise.
Just be grateful your last paycheck didn't boing. On my desk by 11 tomorrow with a pic of one of those snappers. A question, Louisa?
Yes. Is there a new editorial policy no one's told me about that excludes articles containing truth?
Hey, metaphysics seminar's on the roof. Just take the elevator up and keep walking until you hit the sidewalk. Anything is true if enough people believe it. Nancy, what have you got for me?
Nancy O'Hagan has conservative clothes, a pickled complexion, and giraffe-size eyelashes that often come unstuck.
My trusty mole got a picture of the bar on the president's airplane. Wingdings and gin slings on Air Force One.
The dumb monkey says the last drop's been squeezed out of the old soak, but Auntie Nance thinks not.
Grelsch considers. Telephones ring and typewriters clack in the background. Okay, if nothing fresher comes up. Oh, an interview that ventriloquist puppet guy who lost his arms for It Never Rains. Nussbaum, you're up.
Jerry Nussbaum wipes dewdrops of Choco Popsicle from his beard, leans back, and triggers a landslide of papers.
The cops are chasing their own asses on the St. Christopher case, so how about a Are You St. Christopher's Next Slaying piece? Profiles all of the snuffs to date and reconstructions of the victims' last minutes. Where they were going, who they were meeting, what thoughts were going through their heads.
When St. Chris's bullet went through their heads,
Roland Jakes laughs.
Yeah, Jakes, let's hope he's attracted to flashy Hawaiian colors. Then later, I'm seeing the colored streetcar driver the cops had on the rack last week. He's suing the police department for a wrongful arrest under the Civil Rights Act.
Could be a cover story.
Louisa? I met an atomic engineer.
Louisa ignores the indifference chilling the room.
An inspector at Seaboard Incorporated.
Nancy O'Hagan is doing her fingernails, driving Louisa to present her suspicions as facts. He believes the new hydronuclear reactor at Swanakee Island isn't as safe as the official line. Isn't safe at all, in fact. Its launch ceremony is this afternoon, so I want to drive out and see if I can turn anything up.
Hot shit, a technical launch ceremony, exclaims Nussbaum.
What's that rumbling sound, everyone? A Pulitzer Prize rolling this way?
Oh, kiss my ass, Nussbaum.
Jerry Nussbaum sighs. In my wettest dreams.
Louisa is torn between retaliation. Yeah, and letting the worm know how much he riles you. And ignoring him. Yeah, and letting the worm get away with saying what the heck he wants. Dom Grelsch breaks her impasse. Marketeers prove, he twirls a pencil, every scientific term you use represents 2,000 readers putting down the magazine and turning on a rerun of I Love Lucy. Okay, says Louisa. How about seaboard atom bomb to blow Buenos Aires to kingdom come?
Terrific, but you'll need to prove it.
Like Jakes can prove his story?
Hey.
Grelsch's pencil stops twirling. Fictitious people eaten by fictitious fish can't flay every last dollar off you in the courts or lean on your bank to pull the plug. A coast-to-coast operation like Seaboard Power, Inc. has lawyers who can, and, sweet mother of God, you put a foot wrong, they will. 9. Louisa's rust-orange VW Beetle travels a flat road toward a mile-long bridge connecting Yerbus Cape to Swanakie Island, whose power station dominates the lonely estuary. The bridge checkpoint is not quiet today. 100-strong demonstration lines the last stretch, chanting, "Swanakie Sea over our dead bodies." A wall of police keeps them back from the line of 9 or 10 vehicles. Louisa reads the placards while she waits. "You are now entering Cancer Island," warns one. Another, "Hell no, we won't go." And, enigmatically, "Where, oh where, is Margot Roker?" A guard taps on the window. Louisa winds it down and sees her face in the guard's sunglasses. "Louisa Ray, Spyglass Magazine." "Press pass, ma'am." Louisa gets it from her purse. "Expecting trouble today?"
"Nah."
He consults a clipboard and hands back her pass.
"Only our regular nature freaks from the trailer park. The college boys are vacationing where the surf's better."
As she crosses the bridge, the Swanakie Bee plant emerges from behind the older, grayer, cooling towers of Swanakie A. Once again, Louisa wonders about Rufus Sixsmith. Why wouldn't he give me a contact number? Scientists can't be telephobic. Why did no one in the super's office in his apartment building even know his name? Scientists can't have aliases. 20 minutes later, Louisa arrives at a colony of some 200 luxury homes overlooking a sheltered bay. A hotel and golf course share the semi-wooded slope below the power station. She leaves her Beetle in the R&D parking lot and looks at the power station's abstract buildings half hidden by the brow of the hill. An orderly row of palm trees rustles in the Pacific wind.
"Hi."
A Chinese-American woman strides up.
"You look lost. Here for the launch?"
Her stylish oxblood suit, flawless makeup, and sheer poise make Louisa feel shabby in her blueberry suede jacket.
"Fei Li,"
the woman offers her hand.
"Seaboard PR."
"Louisa Ray, Spyglass Magazine." Fei Li's handshake is powerful.
"Spyglass, I didn't realize. Our editorial scope includes energy policy?"
Fei Li smiles.
"Don't get me wrong, it's a feisty magazine."
Louisa invokes Dom Grelsch's reliable deity. "Market research identifies a growing public who demand more substance. I was hired as Spyglass's highbrow face."
"Very glad you've come, Louisa. Whatever your brow. Let me sign you in at reception. Security insists on bag searches and the rest, but it's no good having our guests treated like saboteurs. That's why I was hired."
10. Joe Napier watches a bank of CCTV screens covering a lecture theater, its adjacent corridors, and the public center grounds. He stands, fluffs up his special cushion, and sits on it. Is it my imagination, or are my old wounds aching more of late? His gaze flits from screen to screen to screen. One shows a technician doing a sound check,
another a TV crew discussing angles and light, Fei Li crossing the parking lot with a visitor, waitresses pouring wine into hundreds of glasses, a row of chairs beneath a banner reading, "Swanakee Bee, an American miracle." The real miracle, Joseph Napier ruminates, was getting 11 out of 12 scientists to forget the existence of a 9-month inquiry. A screen shows these very scientists drifting on stage, chatting amicably. Like Grimaldi says, every conscience has an off switch somewhere. Napier's thoughts segue through memorable lines from the interviews that achieved the collective amnesia. "Between us, Dr. Franklin, the Pentagon's lawyers are itching to try out their shiny new security act. The whistleblower is to be blacklisted in every salaried position in the land." A janitor adds another chair to the row on stage. "The choice is simple, Dr. Moses. If you want Soviet technology to burn ahead of ours, leak this report to your Union of Concerned Scientists. Fly to Moscow to collect your medal. But the CIA has told me to tell you, you won't be needing a round-trip ticket." The audience of dignitaries, scientists, think tank members, and opinion formers take their seats. A screen shows William Wiley, vice CEO of Seaboard Inc., joking with those VIPs to be honored with a seat on stage. "Professor Keane, the Defense Department brass are a little curious. Why voice your doubts now? Are you saying your work on the prototype was slipshod?" A slide projector beams a fisheye aerial shot of Swanakee Bee. 11 out of 12. Only Rufus Sixsmith gets away. Napier speaks into his walkie-talkie. "Fay, show starts in 10 minutes. Static. "Copy that, Joe. I'm escorting a visitor to the lecture theater." "Report to security when you're through, please." Static. "Copy. Over and out." Napier weighs the set in his hand. And Joe Napier, has his conscience got an off switch? He sips his bitter black coffee. "Hey, buddy, get off my case. I'm only following orders. 18 months till I retire, then it's off to fish in sweet rushing rivers until I turn into a goddamn heron." Millie, his deceased wife, watches her husband from the photograph on his console desk. 11. "Our great nation suffers from a debilitating addiction." Alberto Grimaldi, Seaboard CEO and Newsweek Man of the Year, is king of the dramatic pause. "Its name is oil." He is gilded by the podium lights. "Geologists tell us just 74 billion gallons of this Jurassic ocean scum remain in the Persian Gulf. Enough, maybe, to see out our century? Probably not. The most imperative question facing the USA, ladies and gentlemen, is, then what?" Alberto Grimaldi scans his audience. "In the palm of my hand." Some bury their heads in the sand. Some fantasize about wind turbines, reservoirs, and, wry half smile, pig gas. Appreciative chuckle. "At Seaboard, we deal in realities." Voice up. "I am here today to tell you that the cure for oil is right here, right now, on Swanakee Island." He smiles as the cheers subside. "As of today, domestic, abundant, and safe atomic energy has come of age. Friends, I am so very, very proud to present one of the major engineering innovations in history, the Hydra Zero Reactor." The slide screen changes to show a cross-section diagram, and a primed section of the audience applauds wildly, prompting most of the theater to follow suit.
But hey now, enough of me. I'm only the CEO. Affectionate laughter. Here to unveil our viewing gallery and flick that switch to connect Swanicky B to the national grid. The Seaboard family is deeply honored to welcome a very special visitor. Known on Capitol Hill as the president's energy guru, full smile, it gives me profound pleasure to welcome a man who needs no introduction, Federal Power Commissioner Lloyd Hooks. An immaculately groomed man strides on stage to great applause. Lloyd Hooks and Alberto Grimaldi grasp each other's forearms in a gesture of fraternal love and trust. Your scriptwriters are getting better, Lloyd Hooks murmurs, as both men grin broadly for the audience. But you're still greed on two legs. Alberto Grimaldi backslaps Lloyd Hooks and replies in kind, You'll only wrangle your way into this company's board over my dead body, you venal son of a bitch. Lloyd Hooks beams out at the audience. So you can still come up with creative solutions, Alberto. A cannonade of flashes opens fire. A young woman in a blueberry jacket slips out of a rear exit. 12. The ladies' restroom, please. A guard speaking on his walkie-talkie waves her down a corridor. Louisa Ray glances back. The guard's back is turned, so she continues on around a corner and into a grid of repeated corridors, chilled and muffled by humming air coolers. She passes a pair of hurrying technicians in overalls who eye her breasts from under their caps, but who do not challenge her. Doors bear cryptic signs. W212 Demi Outlets. Y009 Subpasses, AC. V770 Hazardless, Exempted. Periodic higher security doors have keypad entry systems. At a stairwell, she examines a floor plan, but finds no trace of any Sixsmith. You lost, lady? Louisa does her best to recover her poise. A silver-haired black janitor stares at her. Yes, I'm looking for Dr. Sixsmith's room. Uh-huh. English guy. Third floor, C-105. Thank you. He ain't been around a week or two. Is that a fact? Can you tell me why? Uh-huh. Went to Vegas on vacation. Dr. Sixsmith? Vegas. Uh-huh. So I was told. Room C-105's door is ajar. A recent attempt to erase Dr. Sixsmith from the nameplate ended in messy failure. Through the crack, Louisa Ray watches a young man sitting on the table, sifting through a pile of notebooks. The contents of the room are in several shipping crates. Louisa remembers her father saying, "Acting like an insider can be enough to be one." "Well," says Louisa, strolling in, "you're not Dr. Sixsmith, are you?" The man drops the notebook guiltily, and Louisa knows she's bought a few moments. "Oh, my God," he stares back. "You must be Megan." Why be contradictory? "And you are?" "Isaac Sachs, engineer." He gets to his feet and aborts a premature handshake. "I worked with your uncle on his report." Brisk footsteps echo up the stairwell. Isaac Sachs closes the door. His voice is low and nervy. "Where's Rufus hiding, Megan? I've been worried sick. Have you heard from him?" "I was hoping you could tell me what happened." Fay Lee strides in with the unimpressed security man. "Louisa! Still looking for the ladies' room?" Act stupid. "No, I'm all finished with the ladies' room. It was spotlessly clean. But I'm late for my appointment with Dr. Sixsmith. Only, well, it seems he's moved out." Isaac Sachs makes a huh noise. "You're not Sixsmith's niece?" "Excuse me, but I never said I was." Louisa produces a prepared gray lie for Fei Li. I met Dr. Sixsmith on Nantucket last spring. We found we were both based in Buenos Aires, so he gave me his card. I dug it out 3 weeks ago, called him up, and we arranged to meet today.